Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Five women vying against each other.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 metre peaks.
The 14 highest mountains.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service presents Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jaleel, and at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 23rd of April, these are our main stories. Just hours after the British government passes a contentious bill to deport migrants to Rwanda, five people die trying to sail to the UK from France in a distressing scene witnessed by our reporter.
There were just far too many people trying to squeeze inside this little inflatable dinghy. What we've since learned is that we were watching people almost certainly being crushed underfoot, perhaps suffocated, trampled to death.
A father begins legal action against oil giant BP over his son's cancer death in Iraq. NASA's furthest-flung probe carrying messages from Earth finally phones home after 5 months of no contact. Also in this podcast...
If I'd have asked a year ago, my family or anybody else, if it was a good idea to run topless, I'm sure 100% of them would have said, no, I don't think so. But I didn't ask then, I did it.
The woman who raced topless in the London Marathon to show her mastectomy scars. Just hours after the British government finally managed to push through a controversial bill to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda, there's been a poignant reminder of the human cost of people illegally trying to enter Britain. At least five people, including a child, have died while trying to cross the Channel from France. Our correspondent, Andrew Harding, was on the beach near Calais as people there tried to board an inflatable boat, and he witnessed the chaos that followed. We should warn you that some of his report is deeply distressing.
Suddenly, we heard a noise, and it was the police shouting that they'd spotted some migrants, and we ran with the police and saw about 100, perhaps more than 100 migrants, running across the beach. It was damp, the tide had just gone out, they had several hundred metres to run towards the sea, they were dragging an inflatable, and as the police got closer, essentially a fight began as the smugglers and the migrants started bringing out sticks and rods and essentially forming a protective curtain around the migrants to allow them to continue advancing towards the sea to take their boat into the water. They were throwing firecrackers as well. So there was explosions, there was smoke. The police seemed unable to do anything. They said later that they didn't want to interfere. They saw children there, that it was too dangerous, that the migrants were already in the water. What happened then was that they got into a boat and we saw it drift slowly just a few yards off the shore, but we could very quickly tell that there was trouble going on in the boat itself. There were just far too many people trying to squeeze inside this little inflatable dinghy, and you could see people standing in the middle, and what we've since learned is that we were watching people almost certainly being crushed underfoot, perhaps suffocated, trampled to death. We've heard reports that some people may have drowned. That's not clear. We saw some life jackets in the water. We heard some cries. But at that time, it was not clear to us what was happening. It felt like just a melee that we've seen before as people try and fight for a spot on the life raft, on the inflatable. And then the boat drifted a bit further out to sea. We could see some small rescue boats from a much bigger French rescue ship starting to approach the boat. But at that point, we still had no sense that anyone was injured. We assumed that they were simply trying to offer help and perhaps to push the boat back to shore if it was required, because the boat was not under power. It was stalled. It was just drifting.
These deaths came as a British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has pledged that asylum seekers will start being flown to Rwanda within the next 3 months. The British Supreme Court had ruled the scheme was unlawful. But the Home Office Minister, Andrew Sharp, said Rwanda was a safe country for people to be processed.
This bill does comply with international law. It is profoundly moral and patriotic to defend the integrity of our borders. It's profoundly moral and patriotic to prevent the needless loss of life in the Channel and to put the criminal gangs out of business.
But Stephen Kinnock from the opposition Labour Party in Britain said the asylum bill was an expensive gimmick and wouldn't stop desperate people dying.
The test of a policy like this is, will it work as a deterrent? But when you're dealing with people who have risked life and limb to cross continents, they are not going to be put off by a 1% chance of being sent to Rwanda. So the policy fails on its own terms.
Our political correspondent Rob Watson told us more about how the new law is being seen in the UK and wider afield.
Hugely significant, not just here in the UK, but globally. Here in the UK, because the Rwanda planes policy is an absolute keynote for the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, and intended as a profound political dividing line with the main opposition Labour Party. But globally, because no Western country, no country has tried anything like this. I mean, yes, there have been the idea of processing the claims of asylum seekers in a third country with the aim of maybe coming back to the country. That's sort of what Australia did. This is unique in the sense that these are one-way flights. The idea is you're sent to Rwanda, that's it. You file your claim there and not in the UK.
But the UN has called on Britain now to rethink this plan.
It has indeed, in a truly sort of scathing statement, a joint statement by the UN High Commissioners for both refugees and human rights. And I'm going to read you a little bit of it, Jeanette, for everybody. So they say the new legislation marks a further step away from the UK's long tradition of providing refuge to those in need in breach of the Refugee Convention. They also go on to say that the new law seriously hinders the rule of law in the UK and sets a perilous precedent globally. And that's the point that I was making in answer to your first question. The reason why it's significant is that this hasn't been tried. The UN doesn't like the idea. The UK government argues that this is what is actually needed, not just in Britain, but elsewhere, in order to try and disrupt a global migration movement.
And the key question is, will it work? A lot of scepticism about that, given the fact that so many people risk their lives already to try to reach Britain.
Yes, and the other argument that you heard from the Labour spokesman, which is essentially if you've got 30,000 people arriving last year, 40,000 last year, would sending 200, 300, 400 to Rwanda a year really be a deterrent? But absolutely, that is the test.
And a lot of people are saying part of the reason the Prime Minister has pushed this through right now is because of forthcoming elections. But will it be a big issue for voters?
The polling suggests, Jeanette, that it is a big issue, along with the cost of living, the state of the economy. But here's the difficult thing for the government. The polling suggests that most people don't like the idea of migrants crossing the Channel. The polling also suggests that they approve of the idea of sending people away on planes, whether to Rwanda or to anywhere else. But, and you knew there was a but coming, the polling also suggests that the government is so massively unpopular that even if planes do go to Rwanda, even if there were a sort of a deterrent effect, it probably wouldn't have any effect on the Conservatives' rather miserable fortunes at the moment.
Rob Watson. Ali Jalloud was a keen footballer, a boy with big dreams, but he became sick with leukemia at the age of 15. Last year, he died at the age of just 21. Now, Ali's father has begun legal action against the oil giant BP. Hussein Jalloud alleges that gas burning at an oil field run by the firm in southern Iraq caused his son's leukemia. He said the process, known as flaring near his village, has exposed people there to toxic levels of cancer-causing pollutants, a claim backed up by a BBC documentary in 2022. Our reporter is Esme Stallard. I asked her if this was the first time an individual has brought such a case against a major oil company.
It is, exactly. We've heard before where governments have taken companies to court over flaring, or maybe it's breached regulation. But this is the first time we actually think an individual is seeking compensation where they believe that flaring may have caused harm to them and their family. So it would be a legal first, not just in the UK, but we think across the world.
What is Mr. Jalloud looking for here?
Within the letter of claim, which was sent out on Monday afternoon, so yesterday, and we're just hearing about it now, what he's ultimately seeking is compensation for financial losses, particularly medical treatment that Ali went under. So as you said there, he was diagnosed in 2015. He was battling leukemia for 6 years, and that involved multiple trips, not just within Iraq to hospitals there, but abroad to Turkey, because you can't be treated for the leukemia that he was struggling with. So those costs, the costs in terms of the moral loss of his son, so the impact that's had on his family. But ultimately, when I spoke to Hussein Jalloud over the weekend, he said really for him, he just wants the flaring to stop. You know, it's affecting other families within his town.
And that's the thing, isn't it? It's not just about one family, however sad their story is. This claim follows a BBC documentary back in 2022 that revealed there were high levels of flaring near this village and other villages at Rumela.
Exactly. So a documentary that was done by BBC Arabic called Under Poison Skies, what they looked at is they looked at a number of oil fields that were across the region surrounding Basra in Iraq. And in this case, Rumela and other villages, the flaring was happening very, very close. In some cases, it was just hundreds of meters from their front door. Now, under Iraqi law, it's not meant to happen anywhere within 10 kilometers because gas flaring can be so dangerous. So there are actually many people within the region that are affected by this practice.
And what has BP had to say?
Well, at the time, they said they understand the concerns that were raised in the documentary. And when we asked them about this letter of claim, they reiterated that statement and said they understand the concerns. But the pushback from Mr. Jalloud is that they've said this before. And in the 3 years since the documentary came out, the filming first started, that flaring hasn't changed. And we've seen images and videos very much showing that flaring is still happening. So he's hoping that this letter or this legal action will hopefully change that.
Esme Stallard. It's the furthest human-made object gliding in space, currently around 24 billion kilometres away from Earth. The spacecraft, Voyager 1, was launched back in 1977 with a cargo of gold-plated vinyl LPs containing recordings of Beethoven, Bach and Chuck Berry, along with greetings to any possible aliens out there in 55 languages.
Hello from the children of planet Earth.
Bonjour tout le monde.
Các vị hồ mà. Chúc các vị bình an, kiên hong, phai lọ.
تحياتنا للأصدقاء في النجوم. يا ليت يجمعنا الزمان.
But at the age of 46, Voyager 1 is, like many of us, starting to show signs of aging. After 5 months of the space probe transmitting what's been described as gibberish back to Earth, scientists say they've now found a new way to decode the data. Caroline Porco, a planetary scientist and former member of the Voyager imaging team, spoke to Justin Webb about the issues engineers faced.
They know what the problem is. They've determined that they will be able to fix it, but now they haven't fixed it yet. But what we haven't been receiving is just information from, certainly from the science instruments. And there are instruments on board Voyager that basically sense the environment that it's in. And remember, we've been doing this with Voyager 1 since 2012, after it broke through the magnetic bubble of the sun and it entered interstellar space. And that was a big moment. And that's when they knew they were in interstellar space, and they're learning things about interstellar space, the strength of the magnetic fields, the concentrations of particles, and so on. And, you know, this is exploration.
Voyager 1 is 15 billion miles away now, isn't it? How long do you think it can carry on if it's fixed?
What will limit this will likely be, I mean, unless it has a catastrophic failure where they, you know, it does just never talk anymore and they don't know if they can't do anything about it. If it dies a natural death, let's call it that, it will be because its power supply, the RTGs, the radioactive sources that are keeping it powered, they just peter out. Their strength grows weaker and weaker and weaker with time. And, you know, they're just not going to be powerful enough anymore to even drive the limited activities that the Voyagers are doing now. So I think the expectation is that it will die within, you know, the next 5 years. I mean, they're trying very hard to just keep it going. And, you know, we all want to see it continue because there was no other mission like Voyager. Voyager was, I don't think it's too much to say. It was the greatest voyage of exploration that humanity had ever conducted. It's likely to continue after we're gone. It's an amazing thought, and it's not foolish to feel that those spacecraft, you know, gifted us with some measure of immortality because of that. And it's just such an exalting feeling to think that something that we touched is going to be carrying on. And, you know, it's, if you're into that kind of thing, it's just a wonderful thing.
Planetary scientist Carolyn Porco. A row has broken out between Elon Musk and the Australian government over access to footage that shows a stabbing in a church in Sydney earlier this month. An Australian court has ordered Mr. Musk's social media platform X to take down the video across the world, not just in Australia. But Mr. Musk is challenging the ruling. He said it meant that any single country could control what was posted on the entire internet. The Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, criticised Mr. Musk's decision.
We'll do what's necessary to take on this arrogant billionaire who thinks he's above the law, but also above common decency. What the eSafety Commissioner is doing is doing her job to protect the interests of Australians. And the idea that someone would go to court for the right to put up violent content on a platform shows how out of touch Mr. Musk is.
Anthony Albanese speaking to the broadcaster ABC. We got more from our reporter in Sydney, Phil Mercer.
This is an escalating row between not only the Australian government, but politicians of all political persuasions here, and the owner of the social media platform X, Elon Musk. It's a row over graphic video of a stabbing attack at a church in Sydney a week ago. An Australian court has ordered X to hide videos of the attack. They show an assault on a cleric and also other members of a congregation at a church in Western Sydney. X did say that it would comply with the court order pending a legal challenge, but certainly the argument between both sides is continuing. Elon Musk has posted a meme online that accuses Australia of censorship, and as we've heard from the Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, he's accusing the tech billionaire of thinking that he's above the law and calling him arrogant.
What is Mr. Musk's justification for allowing it to be found on X?
Well, Mr. Musk says that this is all about freedom of speech and freedom of the internet. This video, I've seen it. It's very confronting. It shows a young man casually walking down the aisle of a church towards the altar before a series of blows is rained around the upper body of a bishop giving a sermon. And this ended up online because the service, the mass at a church in Western Sydney, was being live streamed at the time. Now, politicians, as I say, from all sides of the political spectrum in Australia have criticised Mr. Musk, one cabinet minister saying that he was an egotistical billionaire. But Mr. Musk has always said that this is about freedom of information, the freedom of speech, and the freedom of the internet. So in many ways, this is a case that will test how far-reaching Australian laws are beyond Australia.
Phil Mercer in Sydney. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
Some say the lark makes sweet division. This doth not so, for she divideth us.
Shakespeare's love of words and numbers. Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. It took months of wrangling for a huge military aid package for Ukraine to be approved by the lower house of the US Congress, but its passage is all but certain in the upper house, the Senate, when it votes today on the $61 billion earmarked for Ukraine, alongside military assistance to other key US allies, Israel and Taiwan. It can't come soon enough for the Ukrainian military, which is facing a severe shortage of weapons and new recruits as Russian troops advance. So what can the Ukrainians expect? Here's our Kyiv correspondent, James Waterhouse.
If you don't fancy the hill, but aren't in a rush, Kyiv's funicular is a fun way to get from the Padil district by the river to the centre of the city. And as you leave behind the Art Deco-styled station at the bottom, you think about Ukraine's relentless uphill battle as it tries to escape Russia's grasp. The arrival of this American help has brought some relief, but few here are expecting it to result in an instant seizing of the initiative by Ukrainian troops. At the top in this cobbled square, there are half a dozen Russian tanks captured in the Battle of Kiev at the start of the full-scale invasion. But they have gradually turned from green to brown with rust. War trophies are hard to come by these days for Ukraine as we stand under the golden domes of St. Michael's Cathedral. Nevertheless, the arrival of this American ammunition has been welcomed by troops.
My name is Yuri Kochevenko. I am a Ukrainian soldier, and I want on my own behalf and on behalf of my brother in arms to thank every American who, through their actions and citizenship, brought this decision closer. Together we are stronger. God bless America. Glory to Ukraine.
So what difference can this aid really make? Mykola Bieliskov is a military analyst here in Kyiv.
This package, hopefully, will help fully stabilize the front line, ensure proper attrition balance that favor Ukraine, and basically drive Russia to the conclusion that they can't advance. And that would be a minimum marker requirement to say that this year campaign for Ukraine was successful.
The 6 months of delay to this American package has been costly for Ukraine. It's lost more territory and men as a direct result. At this memorial wall near St. Michael's Cathedral, the loss is tangible. There are flowers stretching for 80 metres underneath pictures of soldiers who died from as far back as 2014 with the outbreak of Russian aggression, all the way up to the brighter coloured photographs from 2022 onwards with the full-scale invasion. It's here we meet Svitlana, who's looking to put a photo of her husband here. He was killed last year.
It's good they approved the aid. We need to kick that Russian scum away. I hate them. Why did they come to our land? I see so many young guys here, our finest men. And they are same age as my children. I hope they give us the aid to drive the Russians out so that no one would get killed anymore.
Svitlana is clearly still grieving a year after her husband's death. And this wall will keep growing. But this American help might just bring its end closer on terms that Ukraine might be able to influence.
That report by James Waterhouse. Homelessness in the United States is at record levels, with housing costs increasingly out of reach for hundreds of thousands of people. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court is considering a legal challenge from the state of Oregon over whether homeless people can be detained and fined for setting up encampments in public places. Although the challenge relates to one local area in Oregon, any court ruling would have important national implications for how cities respond to homelessness. Ed Johnson is a lawyer representing the homeless.
The stakes are high. Whatever the Supreme Court decides will become the law of the land. And if people are essentially banished from the city borders, it will be chaos. It will also give people new criminal records. That's going to make it harder for them to find work and to find housing and escape homelessness. If we go down this road of criminalizing people and banishing them, we're going to wake up 2 or 3 years down the road and we're going to have twice as many homeless people as we have now.
Our correspondent, Peter Bowes, who's in Los Angeles, told Nick Miles what Oregon wants the court to allow.
The case centres, as you say, on one town in rural Oregon, Grants Pass, population just under 40,000 people, which has introduced a local law or ordinance which bans camping or sleeping on public property or in city parks, and it defines a campsite as anywhere there's bedding or sleeping bags or where a stove or a fire is set up, conditions that are typical of encampments used by people who are homeless. And violators could be fined up to $295 or face 20 days in jail for repeat offences. And this is a legal battle to uphold the city's right to enforce this policy, but it could indeed have much broader implications for other parts of the country.
I imagine that the people who are opposed to this are asking, how does fining or jailing homeless people help them at all?
Well, critics will say it clearly doesn't help, that allowing cities to punish people who need a place to sleep, they say, will criminalise homelessness and ultimately make the crisis much worse. The city in Oregon says the fines and possible jail time are necessary deterrents for people setting up homeless encampments. And what is interesting, looking at the discussions so far at the Supreme Court, the three liberal justices have expressed concern about how homeless people are treated, noting that sleeping is a basic human need. Justice Sonia Sotomayor said, "Where are we supposed to put them? If every city, every village, every town lacks compassion and passes a law identical to this, where are they supposed to sleep? Are they supposed to kill themselves not sleeping?"
One of the things that happened during the COVID pandemic was that shelter was found for homeless people by the government. Is the government, do you think, planning to extend those kind of measures or let them expire completely?
It appears to be the latter, indeed quite the opposite to extending. Those funds are running out here in California, which is home to one third of the country's homeless population. Shelters, usually hotels or motels set up because of COVID, as you say, have closed. And coupled with the cost of living crisis, rising rents, these are the reasons why homelessness is getting much worse. In almost 30 years living here in Los Angeles, I've covered this story many, many times. And driving and walking around the city, I've never seen it as bad as it is now.
Peter Bowes. The London Marathon, like so many marathons around the world, is not just about record-breaking by elite athletes. It's about personal bests by individual runners and wacky and wonderful costumes which many wear to get sponsorship money for charities. This year's London Marathon raised more than $82 million for good causes, a world record for a one-day fundraiser. Taking part is an act of courage for many. This year, breast cancer survivor Louise Butcher ran the race topless to show the scars from her double mastectomy. She's been speaking to Julian Marshall.
It started off that when I looked around the Facebook sites of ladies who had breast cancer, there was a lot of negativity around mastectomies and a little bit of shame with that. And when I was in the surgeon's office, I was also told that it would be in my best interest to have reconstruction. And I asked why, and she said, from the research, it shows that staying flat and having flat closure surgery will impact you negatively on your mental health in the long run. And I just felt that there was something a little bit wrong with that. I felt that was from a social norm. So I wanted to run topless, which I started doing a year ago. I did the virtual London Marathon first topless to challenge people's perceptions of a lady without breasts, to actually sort of trigger them, because I knew it was going to be shocking, but I wanted to find out where that stigma came from. And especially when you've got scars and you've had your breasts removed and you choose not to have reconstruction, there's a little bit of stigma attached to hiding that. And I felt that if I showed the world or showed people what I actually was without breasts, that made me actually accept it myself, because I wasn't coming home at night after I'd put a top on or put some fake breasts there, taking off my top and looking in the mirror and seeing the scars. If everybody else can accept them and I've shown them to everybody, I'm going to be able to accept them myself.
And what was the reaction of the crowds on the streets of London on Sunday as you ran past them?
It was unbelievable. They were so supportive. The crowd, you could see it was just empowering to them. And I think when I was doing it, I knew it was needed.
You used the word shocking, though, earlier on in the interview. I mean, do you acknowledge that some in the crowd might have found it shocking?
Yeah, and I think for change to happen, you also need to feel uncomfortable. I think when we live in a bubble of sort of a comfortable place, we don't move on, we don't change. You know, any kind of change is uncomfortable, and it's about pushing boundaries, pushing social stereotypes. It's all about being uncomfortable. So yeah, I knew that was going to be the case in some people's reactions, but I also knew that it was needed.
And did you have to get permission from the organisers as a woman running topless in the London Marathon?
I didn't get permission. I feel that when you do something that is going to change, I think if you ask, like if I'd have asked a year ago, my family or anybody else, if it was a good idea to run topless, I'm sure 100% of them would have said, no, I don't think so. But I didn't ask then, I did it. I knew that part of the reason women or men are not seen topless is because they have nipples, and I haven't got nipples. I haven't got breasts. So I knew I wasn't breaking any regulation or rules. I didn't want to risk it not being done because I thought the message was way too important to be told no.
I just wondered how physically you were feeling, not being troubled by having anything on the upper half of your body.
Yes, definitely. There is something very freeing about running without breasts. And I sort of put it to like when you were sort of 9 or 10, when you were a kid and you were running free without your vest on, and it wasn't seen as anything because there was no sort of like social perception of having to cover up then. And you just feel free and the wind's a breeze on your chest. And I actually feel less vulnerable without breasts, to be honest. I feel like a woman, I feel feminine, but I feel less vulnerable. So yeah, there's a lot of positives about running topless and not having breasts, especially, well, obviously when you've had cancer. Don't forget, they have saved your life, the scars. That's what I look at my scars as. They have saved my life and they are going to let me see my children grow up.
Louise Butcher, the first woman to run the London Marathon topless. Shakespeare fans celebrate his birthday today, although we don't know the exact date. He's widely considered the greatest ever English writer, but you may be surprised to learn that he also used maths in some of his most memorable scenes. He lived and wrote at a time when new mathematical concepts were transforming perceptions of the world, from astronomy to probability, music to multiplication. The new ideas were taking off, and much of this was reflected in his work. In Romeo and Juliet, after spending the night with Romeo, Juliet talks about the concept of division, cursing the lark for bringing in the dawn, meaning he has to leave before the lovers are caught.
It is the lark that sings so out of tune, straining harsh discords and unpleasing sharps. Some say the lark makes sweet division. This doth not so, for she divideth us.
And Shakespeare talks about the concept of zero from the opening of Henry V, where the chorus announces that the actors will recreate the Battle of Agincourt.
Can this cockpit hold the vasty fields of France? Or may we cram within this wooden hole the very casks that did affright the air at Agincourt? Oh, pardon. Since a crooked figure may attest in little place a million, and let us, ciphers to this great account, on your imaginary forces work.
Rob Easterway is the author of a new book, Much Ado About Numbers. He explained to Justin Webb the Bard's fascination with maths and how he turned numbers into poetry in his plays.
My thesis is we think of Shakespeare as a guy who's creative with words, but actually, as I've investigated him, it turns out he's very creative with numbers too. And he lived in a Renaissance era where subjects were joined together much more than they are now, really. So, you know, what started as a project as a bit of a joke at a teacher conference in Stratford-on-Avon, a friend and I thinking, oh, let's just theme some maths things on Shakespeare, you know, love triangles and so on. But as I investigated and began searching his work for mathematical words and so on, just began to discover a rich mathematical connection in the world around him, which he mentions and refers to in various ways.
And you make the point that in a clever person of that age, that wouldn't have been unusual. I mean, you would have an understanding of things or an interest in things in the round much more than we do.
A curiosity. I mean, he would not have had much of a maths education. He would have learned arithmetic, so his mathematics would have been very arithmetical. But then even mathematicians, you know, arithmetic was quite a new and growing discipline. And that quote we heard from Henry V is really interesting because a wonderful discovery I made is that basically Shakespeare was the first generation in England to have learned what we now call our regular numerals, the Indo-Arabic numerals. His dad would have been a Roman numerals guy and wouldn't have recognised these things. What we now call zero, that word is a French word, zero. It hadn't arrived in England. It was called the cipher. And clearly Shakespeare is fascinated by the cipher because it's a thing that represents nothing and yet it can make numbers really big. And so there we are in Henry V, basically saying there's only seven of us on the stage, but if one of us is a one and the others are cipher zeros, we can make a million. Let's imagine we're a million.
And that it's his enjoyment too, the subject.
I think so. And the way he plays with numbers, that he will, instead of saying 100 or 50, sorry, he'll say half 100 or double 5 and 20. And one of my favourite examples is in Othello, actually, where Bianca is saying, oh, Cassio, been away for a week, 7 days. But she goes further and says, I want to say how many hours it is. Now, I didn't know how many hours there are in a week. It's not commonly known. It's 168. But Shakespeare doesn't say 168. He says 8 score 8. 8 times 20 plus 8. So not only has he worked it out, but he's made it poetic. It fits in three syllables. It's beautiful. And he does this time and again. And it's just not something I think that anyone, including me, would ever have thought about as him as a numbers guy.
Shakespeare enthusiast Rob Easterway, author of Much Ado About Numbers. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Joe McCarthy. The producer was Vanessa Heaney. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
I'm Mark Lowen from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at divided opinions over the man leading 1.5 billion Catholics. Some see Pope Francis as too liberal, particularly on LGBTQ issues, while others see him as not progressive enough, especially after a recent document he signed condemning gender theory, reassignment and surrogacy. So how much of a reformer is he, and how woke is the Pope?
The mountains are what keeps me motivated in life.
It's where we get to ask ourselves who we are and who we want to become.
At the turn of this century, 5 mountaineers set out on individual missions to become the first woman to scale all 14 of the world's 8,000ers. 14 mountains, all above 8,000 meters.
It was about pitting themselves against nature rather than each other.
They knew only one of them would succeed. But whether they liked it or not, it would come to be seen as a race.
5 women vying against each other.
The media needed to find some competition, and they find it.
A race with deadly consequences.
We are just not designed to live in this environment.
Getting down alive was my only goal in that situation.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.